Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the NBN Entrepreneurship and Leadership Channel. As well as new content, we are making available selected podcasts recorded by our hosts prior to joining the NBN family. This is one of them, and so this podcast may refer to itself with a different name and identity. Enjoy the show.
The centre of innovation is here, and you know this is part of the message of Project Kashmir, of this whole podcast, that there's something happening here which is beyond just good value for money.
Like I said, having the vision is great, but the key is these concrete initiatives that drive it at the ground level.
I think Holland are those people who are really, they do extremely well with very limited resources, and we can take advantage of the really low costs here.
You know, Poland is the land of opportunity, and I like to say the East is the new West, because you always used to go West in history to find more adventure and danger and prove yourself.
There are some good things beginning to happen here in Krakow, but we've got a very long way to go.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, good night, whatever time of the day it is, wherever you are, Project Kashmir listener. Today I've got a special guest, Jill Gross, who's come here from South Africa. And rather than me try to introduce her as best I can, I think it would be better if you did it yourself. So hello, Jill, and who are you?
Hi, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here. My name's Jill Gross. I live in Cape Town, South Africa. I'm an avid reader, have been all my life, worked in libraries, most of my working life in libraries or in information divisions, particularly in the building industry and for architects. But above all, I'm an avid reader and absolutely love books more than anything. So I was introduced to a primary school very close to my house, where the children of my domestic worker were enrolled. And at some point I decided, after finishing work or having retired from work, that I needed something constructive to do. So I volunteered as a helper, a one-on-one helper with an organization called Help to Read, which takes children who are behind and gives them one-on-one attention for half an hour, twice a week. And I wondered why we were operating inside this very nice little library that had a great collection of books and an operating computer, but there was no librarian. So I made some inquiries and discovered that the school had lost its librarian post in 2006, and this was now 2010. And the responsibility for the library had been left to one of the teachers, one or other of the teachers who had far too much to do, so not much was happening as far as the library was concerned. So I indicated that I might be willing to help from time to time, and they jumped at the opportunity, and then it grew from then. So initially I would go in a couple of hours, a few days a week, but from 2012 I started opening the library at 7:15 every morning. And then I'm there for three break sessions, one before school and two during the day. And then as time went on and the teachers got used to me, they agreed to send their classes one by one. So essentially I'm there for 4 days a week, three breaks, and each of the classes from grade one to grade seven comes to the library for a session during which I'm not actually teaching them anything, but essentially I'm giving them the opportunity, all of the children in the class, to choose a book and take it out.
Let me cut in there because you've plunged straight into your story, which is great. And when we were discussing the show, you said you're not sure how entrepreneurial it is, because I was explaining that Project Kashmir is about entrepreneurship and innovation and putting other interesting people on the podcast. And I was explaining that, you know, for me, entrepreneurship is wider than a tech startup. It includes anyone who sees a problem that they wish to, that they think can be solved or can organize a solution of the problem. So can you explain a bit about the context that, well, perhaps give the age, because different countries have got different names for school years and grades. Can you explain the age of the children, maybe their background, because not many of our listeners are in South Africa, too, and everyone's probably aware that South Africa is quite an unusual society. So the age of the children, the background, and what particular problem were you solving that the fact the library wasn't open early could address?
Well, the children are aged from 6 to 14, that's grade 1 to grade 7. Some of them are a little bit old. Some of them start a bit later or repeat a year, so they're a little bit older. So they're from 6 to 14. There are seven classes, grade 1 to grade 7, plus an aid class for children with learning problems. And the socioeconomic background, well, the children are all either black or coloured with a sprinkling of white children. The black children mostly get bussed in from the townships, and the parents are sending them to this inner city or suburban English school because they perceive that they're going to get a better education than they would get in the township. So education is not entirely free. The poorer 50% of kids in South Africa actually go to free schools, but the children at my school actually pay approximately 1,000 rand a month. That's about 250 zloty a month. And on top of that, they're paying for the transport to bring the kids in and take them home in these taxis every day. And that probably costs about another 100 zloty. So these parents are actually paying a lot of money for their children to come to the school. So some of the children's parents don't read at all. They have no books in the home whatsoever. But of course there are a sprinkling whose parents certainly do read and encourage them. So there's quite a wide range of interest in reading, from zero to very keen. So there's plenty of room for motivation and encouragement.
Okay, and what sort of time do children arrive in the morning? And what was happening before you opened the
library? The children arrive, I discovered in 2012 that the children arrive on transport at 7 a.m. The school actually opens the doors at 7 a.m., but school only starts at 20 to 8. So these children were running around in the playground, which is fine. But if there was an opportunity for the ones who wanted to read or possibly play chess or other games or something before school. So, in fact, the headmaster suggested that I might be interested in opening the library early in the morning. I hadn't been aware of the fact that the children did arrive early, and I thought initially that I would try it out a couple of days a week when I wasn't walking. I belonged to a walking group, and I didn't want to interfere with that. But the very first day that I opened the library, 50 children turned up, so I then decided that I had to do this. And that started in 2012, so I've been doing it for 6 years.
And what's the volunteering tradition? Were you a parent in the school, or did you have another role there? How did you come across this school and decide to volunteer?
No, my domestic workers' children went to the school.
I see. And could you name the school? Because probably does the school have a website? Could we post a link to the website?
No, it doesn't have a website. It's called Claremont Primary School. It opened in 1906 and used to be called Claremont Public School and used to be for only white children. But since 1994, after Freedom Day and the end of apartheid, it's been open to all children. But it's a small, under-resourced school. And the what's happened is that the white children have fled to the better schools in the area. The area has some extremely good, well-resourced schools. So the white children have fled, and the school is become, in a way, the student body has become darker and darker, which is a common inner city situation.
But although 250 zloty a month might sound, or 1,000 rand might sound not so much in Poland, in South Africa, what are those middle class parents who can afford to pay those fees? What's the sort of
lower middle class and middle class?
And are the free, is private education very popular of that type, or what are the state schools? Because there is free state education.
No, there isn't free state education. Okay. Only for people who really fall into the lowest economic categories. For example, in the apartheid era, my brother went to a state school, and that was free. I went to a convent, and we had to pay. My children attended state schools in the 80s and 90s. And by that stage, the state schools in the wealthier areas, largely white areas, the government had decided, even before the end of apartheid, that those people had to pay because there wasn't enough money to pay for free education for everybody. So it was decided in the late 80s when my children were in primary school that people living in relatively well-to-do areas would have to pay for education on a sliding scale.
I see. And so, I mean, in South Africa, because we haven't visited the school, at least I haven't visited the school, is the school, is it quite typical for schools to have libraries? One of the reasons I thought it was an interesting potential TEDx talk, I actually suggested to Cape Town, South Africa, that they might get in touch, because it seemed that this would be an idea that potentially could spread to other schools. Do most schools in South Africa have school libraries?
So
this is unusual to have a library at all.
It is very unusual, and it's because the school was formerly a white school in quite a well-to-do area, that it has a really lovely purpose-built library, probably one of the nicest ones in Cape Town. But because the librarian post had been taken away for economic reasons, because there is so much that needs to be done in terms of education and housing and hospital services and so on, that there just isn't enough money to go around, because out of a population of 55 million people, there are only 5 million personal taxpayers in South Africa. And that's the main problem, is that there just isn't the money.
I see. And so really this would be potentially, the idea of opening up but of the schools that do have libraries, would you say they have a similar issue? Would there be other libraries that are also shut when the children could potentially be using them, do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. There are quite a few NGOs involved in setting up libraries at schools. And initially they would set up the library, but not really do too much about having somebody to run it. Well, that situation has changed over the years, and now invariably somebody is trained properly to look after it. Mm. Because at first what would happen is the library would be delivered and then it would be locked up for fear that anything might happen to it and not be used.
So it can't be open without being supervised.
That's right, yeah.
But having supervision costs money, and that's the challenge.
Yeah.
That's
So I do feel that my model could be rolled out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my school actually has the advantage of about 40, over 40 do-gooder, mostly white women, mm-hmm. Volunteering in one capacity or another. There are two reading NGOs that operate, one called Help to Read, which is how I went there in the first place, and another one called Shine, which is a targeted reading program for grade two. So at the end of the first year at school, Shine goes in, tests the class going into grade two, and literally takes half of that class, the lower half in terms of results, for targeted one-on-one phonics and reading revision for the whole year. And I've seen incredible results from that program. So there are about 40 people, not all women, mostly women, but some men and some young people involved with that. And then there's myself and then another a program. So even so, there are still children falling through the cracks. You know, so there's a huge amount of work to be done. But the combination of all the NGOs involved at the school and supported by the library means that some of the children are actually going on to extremely good, the best schools in Cape Town. In fact, last year, my best reader, who had taken out over 400 books, got a full scholarship as a boarder to Diocesan College, which is the top boys' private school in Cape Town. And a couple of my other children, mostly my good readers, have had scholarships to other top state schools. The schools are very good. There are very good high schools in my area. And every year, some of our children do go on to those schools. And I believe that the library has made a big contribution to this.
Yes, well, I remember when you might actually. Why don't you describe how we first met? Because that was quite. That's quite an interesting story. Maybe for some of our listeners are not well up on the ways you can meet people. but also, I remember one of the things that I asked you: can I bring anything? Because we were coming from Europe, and you said, "Bring books." And that was my first. That was the first message. But can you describe A, how we met, and B, what your function is apart? Because obviously you're looking for books, but what do you actually do other than unlock it and lock it up in terms of your day? And maybe describe the atmosphere in the. Do you have some photographs?
Yes, I do. I've actually got photos on my phone. So.
Okay, so I'm sure we can share some of those when we write this up. But so I ask you again. I asked too many questions in batches. But one is how we came across each other. Secondly, what you're doing in the library, and I can't remember my third question. Maybe you can.
Okay. Well, I first heard about Richard Lucas when he applied to me through the Couchsurfing website to come and stay for a couple of days with two of his children. And on reading his profile and seeing that he was involved with TED Talks and so on, I was absolutely adamant that I had to meet him and introduce my children to him, being a great fan of TED Talks already. And when Richard came to the the house and found out more about what I did, he kindly offered to make a donation for books for the school, because in fact supplying the books is another one of the is the other thing that I do. There is no budget for books.
Just to interrupt, if anyone listening to this has access to English language books suitable for, what is it, 6 to 14 year olds. And you can find a way of getting the money together for the postage, I'm sure that I could easily, we'll give contact details so people can get in touch with you and you can discuss. It's obviously not worth sending any old book, because if it's
absolutely
a 19th century Encyclopedia Britannica, will cost you a fortune to ship and won't be read or useful.
Quite, yeah. Well, over the years, I have built up the stock, and I'm actually happy with it, but I'm always looking for specific books. So at one stage, I would accept anything as a donation. So I get donations from friends, I get donations from other schools, Shine, Help to Read from time to time, friends who I talk to in my walking group or in the course of my daily life, sometimes drop packets of books over the fence at home. Mm-hmm. I once walked with a woman who has two children at a couple of the top schools, told her my story, never saw her again. And every few weeks, she turns up with a couple of books, mm-hmm. you know, often new books and so on, which is absolutely wonderful. But I have a passion for secondhand bookshops, and particularly secondhand bookshops which sell children's books. Mm-hmm. So if I travel to English-speaking countries, I usually come home with 3 dozen books. Mm-hmm. A wonderful way to get hold of specific books, parts of books in series or that fill up series or specific prize-winning books, Carnegie Medal books from the US, that sort of thing, is secondhand on Amazon. Mm. And then if I know someone who's coming to South Africa from England, then I order them on Amazon and get them delivered to the friend, who then arrives with a suitcase full of books for me.
I'm just wondering, there's a rather very good second-hand bookshop in Krakow called Masalit.
I've been there.
Oh, you've been there already. Yes. I was going to say maybe I could introduce you to the. Maybe they could do shipping to South Africa.
No. I know all about the English bookshops in every city that I'm going to be visiting on this trip.
Okay, so you got ahead of me there. So we met through couchsurfing, and you told me about this. Can you describe what you're doing in the, like, what a day looks like? Because I do think that anyone listening to this who, you know, it's a certain set of circumstances. The school's got a room where the children could go. The children, when they arrive, can't get in or do anything useful before it starts. And obviously children of any age are a spectrum. They're the ones who will never work unless they've got a knife against their throat and they don't want to work at all. And there are other children who are highly motivated. And it's probably for the ones who are motivated but don't have that much opportunity that this was a real opportunity,
a real boon.
There's a certain set of circumstances. There's some space available. There are children who, given the opportunity, would rather be somewhere peaceful and quiet where they could get on with their studies rather than sort of shivering in a corner or just sort of hanging around looking at their phone or whatever they do. I don't know.
No, well, they don't have phones at school. I don't think too many of them have phones, but they're not allowed to have them at school. No. Mm-hmm. So they come to the library. Before school, they can play chess or other games, even if it's pick-up sticks or Uno or snakes and ladders or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, that gives them the opportunity to learn other skills like, you know, taking turns and sharing and so on. Mm-hmm. We have a teacher who is teaching the children chess, which is very good. So they come, they're allowed to play games before school, and then some of them come to change their books. Mm-hmm.
What's the atmosphere like there? Because then it's obviously, it has to have.
Well, it's fairly noisy.
It's a noisy library.
Yes,
it's not a typical library. No, it's not a church.
Some of the teachers manage to maintain a relative quiet. Mm. Some others don't manage that at all, but we get on. Sometimes children will come in and just sit quietly in a corner. Mm. In every class, there'll be some who will sit quietly in a corner and read. But in general, it's quite a noisy library. So I've got my little regulars who meet me at the door as I arrive at 7:15 in the morning, and they'll be there. They'll come and change their books practically every day. I've got my little regulars.
Would you like to mention their names and then they could watch this later? I'm sure they're not online watching the Project Kazhimizh podcast, but if this is available for them to watch later, are there any particular ones you'd like to greet?
Well, Avi Ware. Avi Ware is an absolute regular. There's another one called Orwam. Now, Orwam lives in a township called Masipumalele, which is near Fishhook. And it's a township which has been through an awful lot of trouble. Orwam doesn't have access to the local library because she doesn't have proof of her address. Obviously, she and her mother are renting a shack or a house or a room in a house or something like that. So she doesn't have access to the local library in Masipumalele, although there is one. And she is an absolutely avid reader who comes to school on public transport every day. And she's probably 10 or 11 and is an avid reader, reading, I would say, unquestionably beyond her age group. Now, she's told me that she's going to be leaving and going to another school, and I'm determined that before she leaves, I will make sure that she has access to her local library, because I very much doubt that the school that she'll be going to will be able to provide her with as much reading material as I can.
Okay, so, well, I think I'm not a great expert in Facebook Live, but there is a way in which this video can stay up after it's over, and then when you're back, or you could send them a link, and they might be happy to know that they're being talked about. Although if you've left anyone out, they might be upset.
Yes, so. Of course. Yeah, no, of course I have children in every year. I mean, I have a wonderful little reader called Melissa in grade 2. Bailey is fantastic. Emilia. I have Daniel and Amir who read great books. I have Tutsurai and his brother Tanaka, who are Zimbabwean boys who are extremely keen readers. I have Nazira Series, who one day, she's in grade 3, absolutely avid little reader, and she came in one day and asked me for books on rocks and fossils, and came back the next day and said she wants to be an archaeologist. But I must say, one of my top wow moments, well, I have wow moments every day, in fact. It's absolutely addictive.
Yes, maybe you could talk about that, because I suppose, you know, in terms of describing the atmosphere, is so familiar to you, you know exactly what it's like. But what are the things that make you, because you have to get up early in the morning,
the
weather's not always beautiful early in the morning in Cape Town, although it may be better than in Krakow sometimes. But what gets you out of bed and makes you do it? What are the sort of the psychological payoffs? Because you're not paid for this.
I'm not paid at all. No, in fact, I pay because I buy the books.
Yes,
but you know, I'm addicted to buying the books.
Yes,
you know, I could be into something else like jewelry or makeup or whatever. But yes, it's children's books that get me up. No, well, one of the main things is that since my husband died, I need to be with people. Mm-hmm. I need fixed time activities involving people. If you live on your own, in order to have a conversation, you've got to make an effort. You've got to pick up the phone or go somewhere or something. And this is actually one of the easiest ways to be with people. Mm. And it seems like a complete no-brainer. All I have to do is get up and be there, and there are people who are happy to see me and need me. Mm. You know, it's addictive.
So what do you do with the children? Because, again, so in what ways are you helping them? Are you helping them read, or are you discussing with them what they should read?
Well, I'm discussing with them what they should read. I, you know, advise them. I recommend books constantly. If I've got if I've got a bright child who I can see is reading more than the average popular girls' books or something, then I will actively suggest books constantly and say, pick out books and recommend books. For example, I mean, in grade seven, there are quite a few serious readers. And just recently, I asked one of the girls if she knew anything about the Holocaust, and she knew absolutely nothing about it. Well, I'm determined that before they leave the school, they must know about things like the Holocaust, and they must know who Darwin is. Mm-hmm. There seems to be something in the syllabus in about grade five about Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. So lots of the children know about Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. But I've acquired, or I attempt to acquire, books on a wide variety of subjects, particularly about other countries and history and local historical situations as far as possible, general knowledge. Mm-hmm. 9/11, for example. I recently found a book on 9/11. In fact, that was one of the ones I got with your donation. So I have a globe of the world on my desk. And often when the children are in the line, I'll say to them, tell me a country that you know something about, and do you know where it is, for example. Mm-hmm. So I've got a lot of maps. Mm-hmm. Which I encourage them to look at and tell me about things that they know. So sometimes I'll say, have you ever heard of France? Do you know about France? And then eventually somebody will come up with one thing, mm-hmm. and then it'll build from there. You know, very often it's a soccer player, mm-hmm. Ronaldo or something like that. So when we had the World Cup in 2010, of course, we had countries from all over the world in South Africa. So that was a time when they learnt about other countries. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm trying to push knowledge about the rest of the world, trying to expand their knowledge of the rest of the world. And I also encourage them to read prize-winning books. Mm-hmm. So, for example, particularly Carnegie Medal books from America. So I encourage them to go around the library and look for the books that have got the gold or silver medallion on them. And I've got some girls. I've got a lovely girl from the Congo called Amida, who is making a point of going around the library and picking out all the prize-winning books.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You mentioned the volunteers, you said mostly white, and I think it would be important to share your politics, because people in Europe, most of our listeners are in Europe, though they're around the world. Not everyone knows South African history that well. And if you could say what it's like being a middle-class white woman in South Africa now, and how South Africa works, because although, you know, and just explain your personal take on South Africa's history and the current situation. I know that's a big subject, but in a few sentences, just explain what you think and believe, because I think your actions tell a story in themselves. But I'd like my listeners to be sure who they're listening to.
Oh my goodness! Well, that is a bit of a challenge.
Okay, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes. But I think it is slightly off topic, but I think it's good to your perspective, Jill, isn't one that that many listeners will have been exposed to, because I'm sure not that many have been to South Africa, and South Africa has a very unusual history.
All right. Well, I grew up in a middle-class, white, English-speaking family. My parents are descended from... my parents were both born in South Africa, but both my grandfathers were born overseas. My one grandfather came from Ireland and my other from England. So my parents were staunch United Party voters. So that was in the apartheid era, the Nationalist Party, which was descended from the Dutch people, they ruled the country. And to a large extent, I lived through apartheid and obviously benefited from the advantages of being white. But you know, to a large extent, you're getting on with your life. You know, your father's trying to make a living one way or the other. And there's a lot that one doesn't really know about. I mean, obviously, you know, I lived through having a maid who lived in the back room, in a room without a ceiling, for example. You know, it never occurred to me to think, why don't we put a ceiling in her room? But anyway, that's how it was. But essentially, my parents were United Party voters. And then I became, to a certain extent, politicized at university and got to meet whites who were actively involved in trying to undermine the apartheid government. And, well, that was in the early 70s. And then eventually, funnily enough, after South Africa got television in 1976 for the first time, things started, it looked like more of a possibility of getting rid of the apartheid system. And in fact, by the end of the 80s, at the same time, not long before, around about the time that the Berlin Wall came down, that was pretty much the end of apartheid. I came from a background that was anti-apartheid, always voted against it, but I didn't particularly do anything to make it happen other than vote in the system. But of course, when 1994 came and Nelson Mandela was released and the ANC were unbanned, we were overjoyed to no longer be the polecats of the world, and obviously hoped that things would go well. And frankly, if the ANC had succeeded in making a real go of it until today, I couldn't have been happier. But of course, as so often happens, liberation movements don't necessarily always make the best governments. And particularly in a case where a party can't be voted out, there's even more danger of corruption. And that's exactly what happened. Things went pretty well under Mandela. I mean, Mandela was absolutely the most amazing hero, as far as I'm concerned. And things went reasonably well under the next president, Mbeki, despite the fact that he was an AIDS denialist, which in the end probably... you know, discredited him to a certain extent. But then, of course, the population wasn't all immediately going to be lifted up from poverty simply because the government had changed. And some 10 years or so after the end of apartheid, when this hadn't happened, not much had changed for quite a few people. Then the majority voted in a populist president in Zuma, who Zuma had the ability to always tell everybody what they wanted to hear. He was voted in, but of course he really got involved in serious corruption. And 10 years later, we've just had a change of president, and hopefully the new one is going to make a better job of it. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that it's not the easiest thing to summarise your personal take on a dramatic history, but also many people in Poland are very used to having to explain a complicated history in a few sentences. If there are people out there to listen, and I think it is good for our. Good for our listeners to know. And maybe interesting, because your husband was an entrepreneur, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. My husband was, yeah.
Can you describe in a few sentences? We're jumping from topic to topic, but we will come back to summarise my reflections on the school library in a moment. But as we've got a lot of entrepreneurs in the audience, or people who want to be entrepreneurs, what was your husband's business?
My husband was an industrial chemist. He studied physics, chemistry, and maths at university, and at quite an early age got involved in a big specialty chemical manufacturing company of which he was the manufacturing managing director in his 30s. He then started moving around, looking for, job satisfaction. He actually had a fantastically interesting job, because it covered chemistry in such a wide variety of fields. For example, one week he would be working on a coal drag line in the mining arena. The following week he would be dealing with a problem of yeast in a food factory. Then it would be water quality in some other industry, and then it would be floor levels, concrete and coatings in the building industry.
And I think you told me when we were visiting in Cape Town that it ended up being additives for concrete and
building materials. Yeah, in the end, he decided to start his own business. I was his second wife, and our children were born when he was in his 40s. So he knew from that time on that it wouldn't do to have a job from which he could be evicted in his late 50s or early 60s, and he would have to keep earning. Mm-hmm. So he started his own business at the age of 50. So he was really an inventor who had a wonderful understanding of what chemicals one could add to a bag of cement and what would happen if he did. If he added this one and that one, this would happen, and so on. So we moved. He opened his own business at the age of about 50, and then we moved to Cape Town when he was 59, where he opened a new branch specializing in floor coatings for the food industry, because most of the food industry was based in Cape Town. Also, having grown up in the Cape, he wanted to live, go back to the mountain, in fact, Table Mountain. He wanted to live near Table Mountain. And thought it would be much better for our children and all of us to be living in Cape Town, mm-hmm. which is absolutely wonderful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, well, maybe one of your children, your sons, I've met both your sons, one of them is an artist and the other was involved in something called Africa Burn. Some of our listeners may be aware of
Burning Man,
but I learned about Africa Burns from someone who helps organize it. So maybe just a few words on each of your children, as they may possibly listen to this too, and you can mention them. I don't know if they'll be pleased, and if not, I'll say, hi guys, I made your mother do this, if you're embarrassed.
No, well, both my children are very creative, and people often ask me if they got it from me, and I don't think so. I can make a plate of food look good, but my main thing is information and knowledge and where to find knowledge and that sort of thing. And I did introduce them, obviously, to books and to galleries. We took them traveling and we took them to Amsterdam, to the Van Gogh Museum and that sort of thing when they were teenagers. So we did certainly expose them to that. And, of course, they had books from a very early age. But their main influence was an art teacher at Rondebosch Boys High. But I think they inherited a creative ability from my husband, who was very, very good with his hands as well, and was essentially an inventor, very creative. So both my children are creative with their hands. So my oldest son is involved with event management in the art world, including having been involved with Africa Burn, the biggest offshoot of Burning Man in the world. Burning Man has 70,000 people. Africa Burn has 13,000. But when my son Paul first started with them, they had 650 people at the first event. Mm. And Burning Man and Africa Burn are opportunities for artists to create wonderful artworks and share them with the public, who don't buy them and put them on their walls, but are more than happy to pay for the experience of seeing them. But they're often ephemeral works, which are not going to last anyway. I mean, they may be built out of recycled materials, for example, but they are wonderfully creative, and people love to experience them. So they then get burnt at the end of the event. Mm. And the following year, the organization sponsors artists to create more, and more people want to go and actually see them. So that's Africa Burn. But Paul also does lighting for the Cape Town Carnival. He builds stages for music festivals. He does special effects in the film industry. Mm-hmm.
Well, if anyone listening needs someone in that, I will put them in touch. And your other son, there's a funny story.
And then, Ian started painting, was obviously good at painting and drawing from an early age, and won the main art prize at the end of his school career, and took a gap year after school, during which he earned money doing portrait commissions. And then decided to go to university and study English and philosophy of art and literature and history of art and so on, while painting all the time. And then eventually did a postgraduate diploma in painting at the University of Cape Town Art School, after which he submitted his best work to a painting competition sponsored by one of the big banks, and won first prize. So that was the prize for the best young artist under 35 for that year in South Africa. And his prize was to go and live in Paris for a year, for 6 months, fully paid for, with access to all the galleries and exhibitions and so on, and an exhibition thereafter. At the same time, he was adopted or taken up by one of the big art galleries in Cape Town, and is still with them, and they give him the opportunity to have an exhibition every couple of years. So he's a full-time painter. He's 33, and he's a full-time artist, surviving on his painting.
Which is also very impressive. So all entrepreneurs of a sort. And coming back to the... the library, which I thought was the library itself, because that already existed, but the idea of making it open for longer. If there's anyone listening anywhere in the world who can think of a school where they'd like to do this, what is there any final message you'd like to give them? Is there any support or advice you could give them of how to get something like that underway? So someone wanted to copy what you're doing.
Well, I think in Europe, you're all pretty sorted.
We do have listeners all over the world. In really, really, we have, like, sometimes on the map, I can see there's someone in Mongolia or...
Well, knock on the door. You know, if you love reading and want to see children reading, knock on the door and see what happens. You know, I didn't arrive with it... The full story right from the beginning. It started with a willingness to simply offer my time for a couple of hours per week, and it's now turned into 4 days a week in term time all year round, and essentially buying the books for this library. But it gives me such enormous pleasure that I can't even begin to imagine life without it.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. And approximately how many children do you think have been through the doors of your library? Every year it's 100 or 200?
Well, there are 240 children in the school, and every year 35 leave, so I can't do the maths.
So let's say it's 200, but are all of them going in the library, would you say? Would every single one go?
Yes, every single one of those 240 children... comes to the library with their class.
But when it's open as a result of you being there, though, because you're not there, you're not the only person in the library, are you? There are other people, or is it only you?
No, it's only me.
Okay, yeah, so really, it's only me. So 240 kids for 5 years, that's like 1,200 children.
Well, no, it's not as much as that, because the same children have been there for they're at school for 7 years.
But yeah. but each year another.
Yes, there's another 35.
So, oh, I see.
It's only 30, it's only 35 okay. in each class. So yeah,
there are probably people out there who can do the maths better than yeah. than you. Or
well,
me.
It's a few hundred, but yeah. but let me just give you one statistic. When I started in 2012, opening the library, prior to me being there, the computer record showed that the children were taking out between 200 and 400 books per month. Mm. The first month that I opened the library early in the morning, the figure jumped to 800 books were borrowed that month. And in the month of March this year, 1,800 books were borrowed.
And how much was it before you started?
Between 200 and 400 books a month.
Before you started, and now 1,800?
It's now 1,800 books a month were borrowed in March this year.
So four and a half times more now
yeah.
than back then.
So 240 children borrowed 1,800 books. Mm-hmm. So people like Aviware and Orwam and Daniel and Melissa and Bailey and Ayakanya and Asive, those children took way more than one book a week. Mm-hmm. They were taking 3 or 4 books a week mm-hmm. and loving it.
So, well, thank you very much. I think it's a really, really interesting story and shows that entrepreneurship can be much wider than starting a business. It's seeing a problem, figuring out you can do something to solve it, and then doing it, not just thinking about it. If anyone listening wants to contribute to the library in terms of money or donating books, we'll post enough information on the website to of when the podcast goes online to make sure that people can do that. And apart from that, any closing message to the listener, or shall we just wrap up?
Let me just think. There's a quote by Dr. Seuss.
Who wrote The Cat in the Hat.
Who wrote The Cat in the Hat. Dr. Seuss is amazingly popular today. And the quote comes from, oh my gosh, I'm afraid I can't remember it at the moment.
I can look it up. Keep talking. Yeah. Well,
It comes from You Can Read With Your Eyes Shut. Mm. It's all about, oh my gosh, sorry, Richard, I forgot.
Don't worry. With your eyes, I'm just Googling it now on a separate computer. Dr. Seuss, I'll see what comes up. You can read it with your eyes. Eyes shut. The great thing about having access to the internet is...
The more that you read, the more places... The more that you read, the more you will learn. The more that you know, the more places you'll go.
I think that'll do. You can always.
Yeah, that's what it is.
That'll do.
Yeah.
Okay, Jill, it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast, and I very much encourage anyone listening to think about doing something similar. Project Kashmir listeners, if you enjoyed this show, do leave a comment. If you didn't enjoy the show, please give feedback. And if you have any ideas of other people who ought to be on the show, or topics you'd like to have me interview people about, that kind of feedback is also very welcome. Please share this podcast, particularly with anyone connected to a school. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for listening to another episode of Project Kashmir, brought to you by me, your host, Richard Lucas. If you enjoyed listening, check out additional podcasts on our webpage, projectkashmir.com, or on iTunes, where you can also subscribe so you never miss an episode, and also leave us a 5-star review if you feel like it. We welcome feedback and suggestions of new interviewees, whether as comments on projectkashmir.com or via our page on Facebook. This podcast was produced by Adam Zuber. Thank you again for listening.
You know, vision is all great and well, but execution is actually the key.
The actual process of meeting those people, working with them, is in itself a huge reward.
Interaction between the university and the business high tech community is absolutely fundamental.
Diversity creates a healthy ecosystem, and I think that I'm seeing more and more of that diversity. It's not just about individuals, but about new individuals. It's about, you know, new initiatives. Sometimes they overlap with each other. Sometimes they might be cannibalizing each other. But the reality is that you want to have as many as possible because that accelerates the big picture.
We're not going to have everyone in the world here, and in this connected world, we don't need everyone here. But the the artists and the designers, the creatives, they're very much part of what we've got and what we need. So if you're listening again somewhere else in the world and you feel you're looking for a place where your creative juices will run, then this city is certainly a place where you can find yourself.
And I think you can make history in Poland. I think you can be part of something much bigger than you could be a part of in the United States right now. Not just from a, you know, going out to San Francisco to make Silicon Valley richer, but making a new part of the world grow at a much faster rate, be a much bigger part of that community, and making it wealthy, not just for wealth's sake, but for a purpose, which is to make that country's government stronger,